Welcome to The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. In this podcast, Vince Menzione, a proven industry sales and partner executive, brings together technology leaders in this forum to discuss transformational trends and to deconstruct successful strategies to thrive and survive in the rapid age of cloud transformation. And now your host, Vince Menzione.
Welcome to the 32nd episode of The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. As many technology professionals congregate in San Francisco for Dreamforce 2017, I'm delighted to welcome a thought leader, sales strategist, growth advisor, and change agent to The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. My guest for this episode of the podcast is none other than Tiffany Bova, the global customer growth, sales, and innovation evangelist at Salesforce. In this episode, we discuss her personal and professional insights on the industry as host of her own podcast, What's Next?, how partners need to think differently during this age of rapid transformation, and her award-winning career journey. Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. Tiffany, welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you as a guest on The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. You and I had the opportunity to interact when you were at Gartner and supporting Microsoft at a pivotal time in the business, and I'm a big fan of yours and excited to have you here today, so welcome.
Oh, well, I'm so glad to be here, Vince, and I'm so glad to have conversation about, you know, something I'm passionate about, which is channels and partnering.
So terrific to have you as well. And at Salesforce, you have an very interesting title now, Customer Growth and Innovation Evangelist. I think that's a really cool title, by the way. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about how you see your mission now at Salesforce and in the industry?
Yeah, I'd say I'm not sure it's shifted very much, right? I'm still get the wonderful pleasure to spend a lot of time, a majority of my time with customers, trying to help them pivot their business and be more oriented around some of the things technology can do for us with things like customer experience, customer success, really improving performance using all the digital tools and how to grow their businesses. So, you know, while I think everyone has known me in this particular, you know, probably listener base around my work on channels and programs and sort of go to market through and with partners, I'd say I still do that. But now I'm looking at kind of growth and sales all up, you know, any way that a company is really trying to reach and engage with customers. And so that's why the title is sort of growth, number one, because I think growth comes in multiple ways. And then innovation is really all of these disruptive technologies and business models and mental models that are out in the market today are really inspiring people to reimagine the way that they have gone to market.
And you now host a podcast yourself, What's Next? And you've had some amazing guests on the podcast. I thought you might take our listeners through why you decided to take this on in addition to your work at Salesforce.
Yeah. I'm just going to laugh because it's just like, I just didn't have anything else to do, so I thought I'd do a podcast, exactly. Which, you know, is not really the truth. I really have been blessed and fortunate over, you know, the last 10 or 15 years to have an opportunity to meet really inspiring and interesting people that are driving change in all kinds of industries. And I get these moments in time where I have a chance to have a conversation with them, whether it's, you know, we're both getting on and off stage, we're sitting in a green room, I'm on an airplane, you know, wherever it might be. And selfishly, as I'm having this, I'm like, God, it would have been great if so-and-so could have heard this conversation. I was just having, you know, a discussion like this with somebody the other day. And it would, how could I have, you know, transported this conversation there? And I said, the best way for me to do that is a podcast. So I reached out to my, you know, network of people that I've met over time. And I was really fortunate that everybody said yes. And so it's really been this opportunity for me to have a conversation with a friend, either over a, you know, cup of coffee or a glass of wine, and have my other friends listen in.
No, it's really terrific. And like I said, you've had some amazing guests. I'm a very avid listener myself. So take me a little bit through, you know, you and I both focus in on transformation, right? We come at it from maybe different angles a little bit, but I've been focused on the podcast on business transformation as it impacts the partner and technology giants and how they engaged in their ecosystem. So I'm eager to have more of a discussion today with you about transformation. So I recall a conversation that you had with our partner organization about the need to transform the business and for partners to break out of their existing business models and monetization models. That was a few years ago. And fast forward now, and I'm seeing this transformation happening more quickly this year than in past years. Are you seeing the same pace of change?
Yeah, I think that when you peel those statements back that I made many years ago, because of where I was working at the time, obviously I was at Gartner, I had this, you know, another 1,000 analysts behind me that were watching, you know, these big macro trends that were happening. And so I spent a lot of time consuming that content and then saying, okay, I'm going to sort of transcribe it back out and say, what would the impact be to somebody who was a, you know, small value added reseller or a systems integrator or a developer, you know, or an SI, you know, or just a consulting partner? And what would be the impact to them if any of this in any degree came true? You know, so whether it was the shift to cloud, I remember having many conversations with people going, you know, there's just no way. And when I say cloud and having those conversations, I started having managed hosting conversations in 1999. I was already working for a web hosting company back then, all the way to 2002. I was the head of sales and marketing and customer service for the largest Microsoft web hoster in the world. It was the first shared web hosting company that helped Microsoft pull together their entire hosting program because we were breaking up SPLAs against licensing and all kinds of things happening. This is 2001 and 2002. And so I've been having this conversation for some time. And when I got to see as things were moving, people would say, oh, I don't think it's going to happen at that pace. And I would say back, look, we can agree it's not negative growth in cloud, and we can agree it's not zero. So whatever number makes you feel comfortable, if 5%, 10%, whatever percent of your business you think customers are now going to shift to these other delivery models, what are you going to do in response? And so it was more of just sharing that this was coming down the pike, and this is what customers were actually asking for, and what CIOs were saying they needed in the business, which meant for many mid-market and small businesses, they rely on partners, they had to come along for this ride. Now, as you mentioned, this kind of speed and acceleration is no joke. I mean, you know, the other day I was reading something that Diane Greene was mentioning, you know, how quickly, you know, the adoption and the pace of innovation is coming out of her organization. And then you have simultaneously Amazon announced that they're going to start charging per second. Per second.
I know. It's amazing.
And it's amazing, right? So then when you say speed, it's like, how do you even keep pace, right? These partners are having to learn new technology, learn new billing models, learn new, you know, coding. All kinds of things are coming at them. And it's really difficult to navigate. And so I think that the speed of business is the new currency. And for partners to be able to help their customers keep pace, I believe actually means that partners working with partners, finally that conversation of P2P collaboration may actually show itself as being a way for partners to deliver value going forward.
Yeah, the monetization models, it seems to be the area where they most struggle, right? I mean, I'm having conversations with partners in interviews that I have and just the conversations in general, and some of them are still struggling with that monetization model. What do you think there?
This goes back to really thinking about, so if you think about the technology disruption that's happened and you have a business model disruption, and then third, if you know, if you're listening to my podcast and Mark Bonchek brought up the whole sort of mental model disruption, that's a lot of movement. And for some of these partners, you know, the average partner is a couple of million dollars a year sort of globally. You know, the VAR 500 clips at about, let's just call it 18 million, 16 million-ish. That means, you know, some 100,000 partners, if not more in the US, are smaller than that. And then the average being in a couple of a million. So how do I transform myself in all three of those veins? And if you pick monetization, the most difficult part of that is that it's the financial model that pays the bills for them to keep doing what they're doing and make investments in some of these new things. So if you can't get access to cash, and which is really hard for small businesses, just not even in tech, you know, and you have issues with small businesses paying you on time as a small business, you don't have that cash flow guarantee. And then in cloud, in many ways, distribution isn't in the middle of that to help you get credit and financing. It's really tough.
That's true. I didn't think about the distribution model and how they fund those partners.
I mean, a huge part of it, right? And so it's hard for them to say, like, how am I going to get access to cash or capital to make investments in hiring a new kind of engineer or a software developer or UX developer or coder? How am I going to get, you know, the funds to pay for reference architects and DevOps? And how am I going to get, you know, sort of business consultants? Those are big, expensive ticket items that if you listen to anybody's research, they're all saying that the skills gap is holding people back from innovation. And the channel is trying to fill that in and they don't have the working capital to get that done.
And so do you think the partners are changing fast enough?
Listen, that's a tricky question. I would answer it this way. I want the partners to be able to stay slightly ahead of whoever their customers are. Because you may have in some sectors and industries where change is not happening as fast for regulations or region or just whatever category it's in. And so, you know, if you're selling Cisco routers, you're still selling Cisco routers. You're implementing and deploying and doing break fix and doing remote monitoring and management, et cetera, right? I mean,
right.
And if you're selling printers, same thing. And I mean, so there are points of time where, yes, the infrastructure layer is evolving around software and pushing some to cloud, of course, obviously, but you still have a business. And so I only want partners to be much more focused and kind of pick what they're going to double down on from a business perspective. And then secondarily say, who are my customers and what are they looking for from me? And I just need to stay slightly ahead of what they're asking. I don't need to get, you know, way out in front, years out. I need to anticipate where they're going to go. And that's different per partner. So to ask, and I know you're just making a, you know, general question, right? But to blanket say, do I think they're moving fast enough? I'd say in some categories, absolutely not. In some categories, I think they're working at the right pace. In other categories, I think that there's lots of room for improvement. And so it really just depends. And then that answers, you know, by region, depending on, you know, who's listening. By region, that matters as well. And then by size company and industry and vertical.
So is there a category of partners that you think are laggard at this point? Or is that fair question?
Yeah, I do. I think that those that are, you know, listen, when the conversation started coming up a couple of years ago that, listen, it's all about recurring revenue, right? Partners need to build predictability into their business. I would always sort of come back and say, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but the break fix business has been around forever and it's always been recurring. So recurring is nothing new. It's recurring on, you know, cloud-based services or as a service services, infrastructure as a service, platform as a service, software as a service, et cetera. But recurring revenue has always been in place. And so partners have been pivoting towards the managed services model long before they started to embrace cloud. So the percentage of business they have that's project-based versus at the first of the year, every year, they don't start from zero again and have to rebuild a $3, $4, $5, $10 million business, right? That some portion of that revenue is going to guarantee come in based on contracts. The amount of or the percentage of that should consistently be going up because it drives a lot more predictability in the business, number one, as I've said. But number two, it gives you a much stronger cash flow. And three, you know, if you've got a strong cash flow like that, you have a much better shot at going out and getting capital to invest further and doubling down on the business. So there's a lot of health. So I'd say those that haven't moved, it's when the split of project-based work and predictable recurring revenue sort of cash coming in has to keep pace, right? So mm-hmm. if you're 30% or 40% in recurring revenue and 60 in project and you continue to get bigger, you always should try to maintain that 60-40 if that's what you want, or you're making a full push to say, I want it to be 70-30. 70% is recurring and much more predictable and 30 is very specific project work that feeds that recurring revenue business.
That's a good insight. What about trends? What are you seeing now that you weren't seeing in the past? Are you seeing from emerging technology trends?
Yeah, I would say that software development, app development, kind of the aggregation of multiple services has been something that I've been talking about for some time. But I think finally people are realizing why I started talking about it as early as I did was because it's rarely a single provider solution. which means from a channel's perspective, you either need to partner with other partners to bring in all those capabilities, or you need to have it in-house, which tends to be reserved for the fairly large partners. But stringing that kind of all those pearls together in a beautiful necklace is difficult. And so that software development side and the software side, I think, is a real opportunity for partners. But more importantly, it tends to be much more about how can they find ways to do it without potentially having to hire the staff themselves.
It's interesting. And you know, the whole partner to partner piece is very interesting during this transformation, as far as what I'm seeing too. It's also a scale issue. There's a lot of point solutions that I'm seeing that are very small but nimble companies, but they don't have the scale of a channel, and they're looking for other organizations to help them there. Are you seeing that as well?
Yeah, I am. And I think even when you look into the Salesforce ecosystem of partners, right, the AppExchange probably being one of the best in the industry and has been, just because it's had such a big head start. And if you were listening to Mark Benioff's mastermind at Gartner Symposium, you would hear sort of, you know, the conversations between Mark and Steve Jobs about sort of the power of this AppExchange and the whole ecosystem and partners and where it was sort of going. And so we were a little early. But I would say that when you look into that ecosystem, overall, you see a lot of partnering going on amongst the partners. Mm-hmm. Because they kind of play like, we are going to be the partner in this particular industry for this particular need of a business. And we don't have the capability on the other side. So who is the partner that I need to go get to? And how do I create APIs to make sure our service integrates really seamlessly with that service? Because our customers want that integrated solution to be easy. And so they're thinking in advance of what that expectation is going to need. And so the partners that I see growing exponentially and quickly are ones that embrace collaboration and even some slight co-opetition. Like, you mm-hmm. could argue in the AppExchange, there's partners that do similar things to what Salesforce does in our own portfolio. But they're like, look, you know, I want to make sure I integrate with Salesforce. Right? At the end of the day, it's customer choice, but I'm not going to take myself out of the game because I feel like I compete with Salesforce in that way, because you know, it's a $10 billion conversation versus a $1 million conversation.
I'm speaking at a conference on IT to IT professionals in a couple of weeks, and I've been thinking about this presentation because a lot of the folks that I'll be presenting to are sort of have that deer in the headlights look in terms of facing the transformation and what to do with their agencies, their government agencies. Do you have any advice you'd share with this audience if you could be there with me?
You know, well, so you have a couple of choices, right? You could go in there and put the fear of everything into them, right? And try to use fear as the light to get them to move forward. It can be one that's an inspiration, right? The story can be inspiring, like almost like the Braille one I just gave. There's so many of those that are just like that.
Yep.
You know, and so do you inspire them to think differently, or do you, you know, lean into a story of somebody who was just like them facing similar issues and similar regulations and what they did in order to overcome the, you know, the inertia that gets stuck into businesses that have been around for so long that they get trapped in their own way of thinking, you know, and there's no diversity of ideas and they just keep coming up with the same stuff on a different day. So it all depends sort of what, you know, what story arc you want to give and what you want them to get out of it. But, you know, I think scaring people into, you know, skyfall isn't quite as effective maybe as it used to be, because there's just so much information out there where they can consume that it's now, how do you sort of cut through the noise and give them some really actionable ideas they can walk out and do something different on Monday morning?
Yeah, it's just a matter of how do you get them to mobilize? How do you get them to move, right? And you said there's ways to motivate them, I guess, is what I'm hearing. And I think back to some of the conversations you had with the partner ecosystem at that early stage in transformation, right? And trying to get them excited about the change and how they needed to mobilize their businesses.
Yeah, and I focused on the customer. I always focused on the customer. Look, I can stand up here and tell you what I'm going to tell you, but I'd rather tell you from the mouth of the customer, here's what they're looking for. right? They're looking for ways in which they can engage with their customers better. I'm just going to pick that one, right?
Yep.
The customer is saying, look, I want to be able to be in multiple channels and deliver a similar result and a similar experience, if you will, regardless of whether they want to connect with me via SMS, Facebook Messenger, chat, email, or telephone. That's what I'm trying to do, because I've noticed now that my call times, it's not just about 24/7 over the phone. It's about all these other things. That's what they're saying. And so the partner has to turn around and go, how do I deliver this? And instead of me standing up there and going, the trends are that omnichannel is going to overpower, right? And I come from the customer side and say, 65% of customers are saying that if they're in five or more channels, and then the person in the audience goes, oh my God, we're only in two. Mm-hmm. You know, and then they may come back and go, well, we're unique, which is the normal, right? We're unique. We're in an industry that, and I'm like, I'm sure you are. Everybody thinks they're unique. And in some industries you will be, but let's just say it's not five. Let's say it's three, you're only in two. So what are you going to do to get to the third?
Right.
So I don't need you to go all the way to five, but I do need to tell you that two, like phone and email, not enough. And I don't even care if you're a government agency. Like, it's just not enough, especially as, you know, the millennials and more and people who are getting more and more comfortable with technology want to engage with brands in multiple channels.
Those ones who say that they're unique, those are the ones who get disrupted, right? I mean, that's the ones that either disrupt or be disrupted. And that's what it reminds me of.
Yeah, absolutely. And or they're just so late that they have to catch up. And unless... 52% of S&P 500 companies have disappeared in the last like 60 years. And the lifespan has gone down from, 60-year lifespan to 17 years. Mm. And that happens because people are complacent and don't think that they're going to get disrupted. And then if they do start to get disrupted, they actually focus in on the wrong things. They try to fight it without actually saying, okay, wait a minute, why is this happening? Like if I pick, the black cabs and Uber in London, it's, let me fight them with regulations versus saying, hold on a second, why are people choosing Uber over black cabs?
Yeah.
Because maybe they don't know how to get around the city as well as we do. So that's not important to them. Like, what is it?
And ultimately it comes down to things like cost, convenience, right?
Speed delivery. Yeah. It comes down to experience. You know, more often than not now, the experience is actually the product. And that makes people who are very comfortable with product very uncomfortable.
So what excites you most about the future and what keeps you up at night?
Yeah, I'd say I'm really passionate about this whole talk track of customer experience being the new battleground and experience being the new product. It has so many legs to it around CRM systems and, digital marketing and social listening and journey mapping. And then from a strategic standpoint, making sure that companies are pivoting towards the customer and not being product led, but being customer led, and really changing maybe even an entire culture and DNA of a company is super difficult. But that's what is super exciting to me, is where you see people really uncomfortable with the conversation, you know that you're getting through to them in a way that they don't feel comfortable and confident about what to do next. And so then they get much more open to saying, I don't know how to navigate it. And then you start to have these really rich, super fascinating conversations about the options and the ways in which they could potentially navigate this disruption. And it's really inspiring, number one. But number two, for me, it's like every day I learn something new and I hear someone try something different that I maybe hadn't heard before. And I get to follow up on how it worked or didn't work. And more importantly, how the technology underlying it, obviously more times than not at Salesforce, how we're powering those transformations is just super exciting.
So I know you've described yourself as a recovering seller. And I'm going to ask you a little bit about your career journey in a while here, but you also have a lot of this experience with the channels and teams. And what do you believe makes, or what characteristics do you believe make a great partner?
Yeah, I call myself a recovering seller because I always pivot back to companies make stuff, companies sell stuff. And you can make the best stuff, but if you can't sell it, it's really difficult. And in many ways, it almost doesn't matter. So I think everybody has a role, to use Dan Pink's term, right? To sell as human. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a role in the company to quote unquote sell. You may not have salesperson on your business card, but every decision you make has an impact in the way the company transacts with its customers. So that's why I think sales is at the center. And I don't mean always has to be and runs the company. I don't mean that. I mean, but if you're in a profit-oriented business, you have to sell stuff. For partners that are a little bit more product-led, I think this is where they've had a real challenge in making this switch, because they're always like, okay, what's the product I can sell to solve the problem? Mm-hmm. And in the last 18 or 20 months that I've been here, I've really realized, for me, the truth lies that this is not necessarily a technology problem. It's a people process problem. And that's much more difficult to change. Salespeople today, if you're selling technology in any way, I believe you're not selling technology, you're selling change. And change is hard. It's hard in our personal lives, and it's really hard if you're selling it into a business that has multiple agendas and different personalities and different siloed groups and lines of business and all kinds of things going on. It's really hard to sell change. So I think for partners, if they can start to realize that they have to think about technology as the vehicle by which they're delivering sometimes massive change into an organization, and change management becomes even more critical.
Yeah, I believe that's true as well. I think when you think about some of the great partnerships that I think of, it's always about aligning to a set of principles and sort of a shared vision that you're selling to the customer. It might be in partnership with that technology giant that you're working with, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But even if you think about a manufacturer or vendor trying to go into a large ecosystem that has predominantly sold on-premise in a resale model and then turns around and says, oh, no, no, it's not going to be hardware anymore. It's not going to be product anymore. It's going to be a cloud-based service, and it's going to be recurring revenue. So you're not going to be selling millions of dollars. You may be selling tens of thousands of dollars. And the industry is littered with vendors that have been working for years in trying to get their ecosystem to pivot. And that was all about change. The technology was there, right? Yep. Infrastructure as a service is there, and platform as a service is there, and software as a service is there. So if you had an established ecosystem that was not used to that, it's been a good 5, 6, 7 years of pushing, I'm trying to get you guys to change. Different for a company like Salesforce that started in the cloud and the ecosystem isn't changing. It's the ecosystem has to keep pace with all the things we're doing with our multiple clouds now, not just Sales Cloud. And so that's about investing in more things than just the CRM side of it. And that change is still change. And so, going in and messaging and what's the power and the value of now selling Marketing Cloud or now selling Service Cloud or now selling Community Cloud, whatever it might be, like, why do you want to do that? Like, trying to get you to embrace the fact that we have more things for you to do. So change is change. But I think vendors, if they're using partners, third parties, to either resell, implement, train, do distribution, whatever it might be in the supply chain, it's still having to convince them to want to come on this journey with them and make the investments to not only change technically, but change their, going back to your question, right, the business model, the monetization model, the revenue model, all of that has to change. And it's tough.
So asking the question conversely, the partnerships that failed, are those the ones that don't buy into being a change agent, to being a transformer, if you will, of the business?
It could fail for a lot of reasons, but that's one for sure. I mean, I think that at the end of the day, CRN magazine did some great work around, you've got kind of those lifestyle partners that are really happy with the business that they've built. And they're like, look, I'm very content. I just don't have enough, gas in my tank to go down. I'm going to transform and completely redo my company and come out the other side looking totally different. Then you have some that are like, I'm willing to transform, but I'm going to transform very specific and very strategically. And then you have others that are like, yep, I am all in and I'm going to flip the model and go totally to managed services and resell nothing and go totally to cloud. Maybe I'll start in a completely different division so that I can slowly, you know, pull back on the resale side of the business and pivot more towards consulting. I mean, so it all depends kind of how a company wants to grow. And if they've said, I'm now going to pick one of those and that's how I'm going to grow and it doesn't work out and they fail, you know, it could be all kinds of reasons. But I feel like some of the failure happens because they don't make any decision. They just sit on the sidelines and go, I think I can continue doing what I'm doing. And then slowly over time, it gets more difficult and more difficult and more difficult to put, you know, revenue on the top line and hang on to customers on the bottom line.
Mm-hmm. So they're hanging on to the past, basically.
Hanging on to the past. And some have, you know, some are able to continue to do it. And why I go back to my earlier comment, because their customers are comfortable in the existing model as well.
Right.
If the existing customers are like, I just want it on-premise and I don't want anything in the cloud and I want business to stay exactly as it is, and you're a partner who's very happy staying and doing exactly what you're doing, right on. It's only if you're like, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing and your customers are saying, I want to change, and you're trying to get your customers not to change, they're either going to change with someone else or they're going to force you to make that shift.
Right. And if you're not the company that they perceive as being capable of helping them make that shift, they're going to go someplace else.
Yes.
Yeah.
They will go someplace else.
So what about common myths? You know, you've worked with many organizations, very many big companies out there. Are there common myths that you see that organizations have about the whole concept of partnering?
I'd say the biggest challenge is, you know, if you've got a vendor who has historically motivated and rewarded their ecosystem for resale, it's difficult to get them to shift away from that spigot of MDF and co-op dollars and lead distribution and all that kind of programmatic value, if you will, and get them to make investments that may have no component of resale in it. So the dynamic between the relationship actually changes. You know, now it's not about that margin in a product. It's about revenue on the professional services side that maybe the vendor has no skin in the game, right? It's just opening opportunity for a partner to come in and add value on top of the transformation that the customer is doing using the technology that's maybe made from the vendor that otherwise wouldn't be deployed. So, I mean, you can use Salesforce as an example. You know, partners are not reselling the technology, but they're coming in and around it and consulting on what is the change management? What is it going to look like? You know, how do we integrate it into the environment? What APIs need to be done? You know, let's architect what a sales transformation actually looks like. And the technology underneath that is powering it. And they may do some things to the technology itself, but the professional services revenue and their own services is where they're making the money.
Yeah, and some of that's a discovery process for these partners, right? Like all of a sudden the transactional revenue has gone away and now I need to find another place to recoup the revenue.
Exactly, exactly. And it gets difficult for them to wean themselves from the resale spigot, you know, while at the same time they're going after this new revenue because they're not comfortable or confident in the fact that they'll be able to ramp the new revenue as fast as they need to as the old revenue is declining. So you have to make a conscious effort. And I had this conversation with a partner a number of years ago, and he was an agent for a large telco, I'm making up the numbers, but let's say he was around 40 million in revenue. So a nice size partner. And he had heard me speak a couple years before, and then it had been like 3 or 4 years. And so we ended up sitting next to each other for lunch. And he said, I'm so glad I got to sit next to you because I wanted to tell you the story that, you know, we heard what you said and we really started to pivot ourselves away from the old revenue model that we had been so wedded to for so long. And we started to pivot more towards recurring revenue and managed services. And we developed our own tools and applications that made us stickier with our customer, et cetera. And we actually let and they were not publicly traded, by the way. And we let our revenue decline, our top line decline, almost in half while we ramped up the other side of the business. And now we're probably a little larger than half the size that we used to be, but we're like 3x on the profitability, right? We have much richer and tighter in relationships with our customers. And it's interesting how few partners I've met along my ways, right, along my journeys, that have been willing to do what I just described. And I'm talking about private, right? So it's not the street saying, oh, no way, you can't cut your revenue in half. This is their own, I need to be a $40 million company, or I need to be a $20 or a $5 million company, because I need to maintain my level in the channel program or whatever it might be. But holding on to how large you are from a top line perspective may actually be holding you back from that profitability lever that you're unable to pull.
That's really interesting, because I think about that only with public companies, right? And I could think of some public companies that we know that have gone private and are able to do some things and maneuver differently because they're privately held. But that's interesting that you mentioned that about private companies.
Yeah, or you look at, you know, a very public one in an IBM that's in the middle of a transformation and public, and, you know, 21 quarters of declining revenue.
Right.
But it's a huge shift. I mean, let's sell off, you know, $20 billion worth of our asset. I mean, you know what I mean? It's been, it looks nothing like it looked 20 quarters ago. But you had to kind of be that size, or you go the Dell model and you pull it private. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think that it all comes down to, you know, some people start a business and in our industry, in our world, right? And they love technology. They're technologists at heart, and they want to go do cool stuff with technology. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they are able to then navigate the business through some of this stuff. So, you know, I would say, if you're listening to this podcast and you're saying, yep, I hear it and I don't know what to do, is to get a business coach or to get an advisor to come in that focuses on small businesses and really helps you understand what are the things that you could do to move yourself along this journey, but you need to be able to communicate to them where you're trying to get to, and really understanding what's happening in your business today so that you can share it, because no one knows your business better than you do. But that's a blessing and a curse, because you're so close to it that you may not be able to see the forest through the trees. So bring somebody in who's got the ability to have an open mind in the ways in which you could approach transforming yourself and your business. And it might mean bringing somebody in to run the operations side of it, to help guide you through this transformation yourself while you continue to focus on the technology side.
It's some really great advice for partners. So hire a business consultant to come in and help them through the transformation.
Yeah, or even just a business coach, a personal business coach, right? I don't mean that it has to be you bring in a McKinsey, right? Or a Bain or a Gartner, or, you know, just somebody who can help you dissect parts of the business that you've grown up learning on the job, and they've got experience that you don't have, and what can they help you navigate? And it's all about, you know, you don't know what you don't know. And I think business coaches are a great way to have people expand their horizons and maybe get a different point of view. And also on one of my podcasts, Naomi Simpson, she's a Shark Tank shark down in Australia. And she has a very successful small business, obviously, because she's a shark. But she's like, look, I'm a great leader and I'm not a great manager. So I can set the vision and figure out where I want to take the business and what I'm truly trying to accomplish. But sort of the day-to-day, I needed to bring somebody in to run the business because it's not what I'm strong at. And, you know, I think that is a great lesson to learn for knowing what your strengths and weaknesses are. And if, she doesn't call them weaknesses. She calls them non-strengths. So what your strengths and non-strengths are, and then double down where you're strong and bring people on board to help you in those non-strengths.
Yep. And also to separate some of the emotion, right, that some of these entrepreneurs have about their business and that ownership of their vision and strategy.
It's that, and it's the emotion tied to how big the company is from a top-line revenue perspective.
Yeah,
as you shared. Which is another one. Yeah.
Yeah. So any closing advice for partners before we shift gears here on the rapid age of change and what they need to do to embrace the change?
I think it's a moment of reflection. I think that we have been, as you mentioned a little bit ago, this pace of change is not slowing down. You know, we're now talking about Amazon billing by the second. And I think Google is doing the same. And it's not going to get any slower. So if you don't take time for sort of quiet reflection on being really mindful of where you want to take your business, and more importantly, you know, where you want to take your employees. Because if you are an owner of a channel company or an owner of a small business, you not only have responsibility to the company all up, but to each individual employee, right? You write their paycheck. You know, you are the leader, you know, you're the captain of the ship. And so don't just let the boats leak, knowing that you can't fill the holes fast enough. And so if you can inspire and motivate the vision of where you're trying to take the company, communicate it on a really regular basis, bring in people to help you in those non-strength categories, you have to make sure that your employees understand their role in the change, where you're trying to take it. Because if your employees are happy, your customers are happy. And if your customers are happy, they're going to buy more for you. They're going to talk about how great you are to them, all of those things. If you just focus on what it is you're selling from just pure technology, you're not connecting with your employees or your ultimately your customers in a way that is as meaningful as it might have been just a few short years ago. So I think it really is taking the time, you know, every day to just pause and reflect on what's working and what's not working, and how can you start to rally people around your ideas and your vision, and then really trying to find that business coach.
Some really great nuggets for our listeners. Thank you. And, you know, I focus on how people got to this spot in life. And I wanted to focus on your personal and professional journey for our listeners, Tiffany. You've had an amazing career. And I have many of my listeners are early in career professionals looking to learn from someone like yourself. Can you take our listeners through your journey?
Well, I would say this. I would say that my 20s were just whatever I can do. You know, like I knew I was kind of good at sales, and I sort of, you know, sold all kinds of things. And then in my 30s, I got a little more serious. I sort of found my way to selling technology, and I found something I was good at. And I started selling technology early around some of the big macro trends, accidentally, by the way, right? It was just kind of no master plan. And through my 30s, I changed jobs about every 18 months, which was really frowned upon at the time. But I did it because I wanted to challenge myself more, and I wanted more responsibility, and I wanted to try new things. And I always went back to my employer and sort of offered the opportunity to say, hey, I'm looking for something different. I'd like to stay here. And if they weren't able to sort of find a place for me, I would move on. And then sort of right at my 40s, I said I needed to take a break on the merry-go-round I was on of changing jobs as frequently as I was and carrying a quota that had become a fairly big quota at the time. I was running one of the divisions of Gateway Computers when it was still around. And so it was a good size quota. Mm. And I needed a little break from that. And so I landed at Gartner through my 40s. And then I got the opportunity, although I'm only 36, I got the opportunity in my 50s to work at Salesforce. And I've been here, you know, 18 months or 2 years. But I would tell you that for me, there is no greater joy now for me than being able to look back and know along the way that I never did it alone. And I had a strong network around me of both men and women that would guide me, you know, especially on the channel chief side. You know, during that time, it was Allison Watson at Microsoft was one of my early mentors, Frank Battigliano from IBM at the time. That's where he was. Yep. Allison Seelinger was at Symantec, and Julie Parrish was at Veritas, and, you know, Ross Brown was at VMware, I think, at the time. I mean, you know, so I had this really strong network. Even Chuck Robbins was running US channels for Cisco, and obviously now he's the CEO. And so I was really fortunate to have a strong group of channel chiefs around me that gave me great advice. And then I started sort of building that network even beyond sort of the channel chiefs, if you will. And there were very pivotal times in my career where I leaned on those mentors, but I didn't have it in such a formal mentorship. I mean, there's probably a handful, you know, Kevin Gilroy from HP at the time, and then, you know, went on to OnForce, and then went on to Arrow, and then went on to SAP, and went on to Samsung. And now I think he's living the luxury of retirement. But you know, at the end of the day, it was really about having a strong network of those that were willing to just have conversations with me and lead me down some paths. And so I'd say from an advice perspective is your network is your net worth. And for career advice, for making moves, for references, for learning new things, it is, you know, the fabric of what makes you up in your professional life and your personal life. But from a professional standpoint, you know, I am the result of this fabric of all these great, amazing relationships that I've made along the way, the conversations I've had, the people I've met. Because I would say this, there were so many times where people believed in me more than I believed in myself, and they gave me the opportunity to try something that was definitely a stretch for me. And I trusted that they wouldn't just leave me out there to hang and dry, right? I knew that they would give me support through that learning curve, and it made all the difference. So for me, I always take the time to thank the people that helped me along the way, as I just mentioned, a slew of them. And, you know, and also to give back. You know, I think now in my career, it's doing podcasts like this and speaking at events of trying to share and impart some wisdom of, you know, battle scars I have and things I've learned. And obviously there's still a lot to learn for me, but I feel like I'm at this great point in time where I've got a good balance of learning and giving back.
So is there a piece of advice that you remember or recall at a pivotal time in your career that maybe you could share with our listeners?
So I have, you know, I give quite a bit of keynotes. I probably do 50 or so a year or somewhere around the world. And this one, I use this as all the time because people just can't believe that this is what he said. But I was getting on stage and he was getting off stage, and it was Guy Kawasaki was getting off stage and I was getting on stage, and we have spoken together a number of times and we went to rival high schools. We're both from Hawaii. And so we've known each other for some time. So he's getting off, I'm getting on. He looks over at me and he goes, "Hey, Bova, don't suck." I'm like, "Okay." Thanks, man. Appreciate that. So I, every time now, like, it's so funny, whenever I'm getting like off stage or on stage and someone's just like, you know, go for it, have a really great time, I go, all I'm trying to do is not suck. Right. And yeah. So I hear a guy in the back of my head, you know, saying that to me. So, you know, well, I made you laugh, right? It was just classic. It's just sort of classic guy. And he said it with a smile. He wasn't being like, you know, mean about it. He was definitely being funny. So that's one. So, you know, I always aspire not to suck when I'm getting on stage. And then another one would be that there are things that I am better at than others. And I was trying at one point in my career to try to do lots of things well, and it just wasn't working. And I'd say the piece of advice that was given to me at that moment is, once you identify your strengths, that's what you need to double down on. And it's not that you don't need to understand the things that you maybe are not strong on. And that's that sort of, you know, bring someone in for help, or, you know, surround yourself with people that are smarter than you in other parts of the business. And when I got that piece of advice and started to make different decisions in who I hired and how I organized my time and how I collaborated and partnered with my own companies that I was working at, my career really took off. It was when I was trying to do everything that I was actually holding myself back. So I would say that those are probably the two pieces of advice. Guy's was much better probably than the second one, but that's what I would say.
So was there one thing you held on to and one thing you let go of in terms of those skills?
I let go of trying to be strong in finance. It was never my strong suit. So, you know, I took some classes, continuing education classes on just learning how to walk my way around a P&L, but I didn't need to run it. I needed to understand what questions were being asked and how to find information and how to look at numbers and understand what they were telling me, but I didn't need to run it myself. So that was one that I let go of, and I should have probably let go of much sooner than I did. So that was probably one. On the double down is I am a great storyteller, and my ability to get teams to pull together and sort of all walk and march towards a vision and getting, you know, at one point I was running sales and marketing and customer service, which back 15 years ago in tech was three very siloed organizations. And how do I pull them together? I think it had a lot to do with being an athlete my whole life and working and, you know, playing on teams and being coached and understanding the roles that we all play and how do you get teams to work together that maybe were, you know, not normally teams. I think that that's really what allowed me to gain more responsibility along the way. And then from a Gartner perspective, I'd say my ability to look at all the stars in the sky and see the Big Dipper and really visualize the patterns in what information and data was coming out and what's the story that it's really trying to tell and how can I communicate that to thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people over the course of, you know, a decade would probably be where I doubled down there.
So when you're facing a difficult challenge, is there a greatest hurdle that you faced, that you overcame, that you reach back and you recall? Is there anything there that you pull back on that helps you through an obstacle?
So my grandfather used to say to me when I was really young that patience is a virtue. I have none. So it is one I continue to struggle with, that I just kind of want it all done like yesterday. And so how can I always lean into being more patient, both with customers and people I meet and things I'm trying to do and, you know, timelines and all kinds of things, right? I think patience is one that I continue to struggle with. And I think it goes back to the comment I was making a little bit ago, is I've been working on taking time to reflect on, okay, what is it I need to do and what are those obstacles and what's the best way for me to overcome them? And also, if I've always done it a certain way, like how about try it a different way? You know, just communicate a little bit differently, or don't send an email, pick up the phone, or, you know, maybe approach it in a different way and ask for help instead of just telling them how to fix something. Or, you know, it really is that I try to be a student of what I do every day and learn. And, you know, some days I'm better than others, but I think that, you know, the cross I still need to bear is my lack of patience.
That's a great one. I'm thinking a little bit more about that one and saying, is there any specific skills or approaches you take in terms of doing that? But I think you covered some of that here.
Yeah, I would say this, that normally I will answer a question pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. My brain is always sort of on, and even when someone's talking, I've really had to work at not thinking about what I'm going to say, but actually listening to what they're saying so I could process it, so I could say something a little bit differently. And so just taking a pause on the response and pondering what the response would be, difficult in a podcast like this because, you know, obviously we have a set window of time, but if we were sitting face to face, to be a little bit more thoughtful on the response so that you actually reflect on what's being asked and what's the best way to do it. I think just even taking a beat really helps on connecting with the people you're communicating with and also working on that patience side of things.
Yeah, I think I heard that referred to as golden silence. I remember it was Stephen Covey or maybe another author in one of their books about...
Yeah, it's just a beat.
Yeah.
It's just a beat, you know? And if you're talking to somebody, like if, you know, if I were talking to myself, I'd be like, come on, come on, come on, answer me, right? Because you know, I have no patience. So it's also in the return that if someone is being reflective and taking that moment of golden silence, that you let them do it.
So any advice you'd give to your 25-year-old self?
Oh, yeah. So I wrote a blog on LinkedIn with this very question, like what would I do? What if I could go back? It would be, don't sweat the small stuff. That would definitely, you know, the things that got me all wrapped around the axle from a career perspective in my 20s and even my 30s seem so insignificant today. So, you know, it would definitely be that. The other thing would be that although I did a good job at it, I don't know what I would have changed differently, but I didn't have my master plan in front of me that the decisions I made to change jobs and work at Gartner and now work here. Start a podcast, I'm writing a book. I mean, all the decisions that I've made without a master plan, it kind of worked out okay. And so that's why that not really having a plan has worked for me. But I think ultimately I had some idea of where I was trying to end up. I just didn't know what that looked like or how I was going to get there. And I'd say that, so, you know, don't sweat the small stuff. And the second would be trust the process. Just trust the process.
So visualize for our audience where you'll be in 5 years. What does that scene look like?
Oh boy. More patient. I still am hitting on Guy Kawasaki's advice. I'm doing all right on stage.
Don't suck. Yeah.
Don't suck. My book will be out. So I'm hoping that is a success. And I'd say, you know, just doing more of what I'm doing today. I'm really, really fortunate. I love what I get to do every day. I'm excited and inspired by it. The amount of time that working at Salesforce allows me to do and giving back. I recently spoke at the UN. I do a lot around girls in tech. I mean, those things are just really rewarding on so many levels. And so I hope it's just more of the same. I hope it's more of the same.
That's great. And one more question. Is there one book, and I know this is going to be a tough one, but is there one book that you have read or gifted often that you'd recommend to our listeners?
Oh, well, early in my career, Purple Cow by Seth Godin is just one of my all-time favorites. I mean, it's just really one of those books that stands the test of time. And, you know, and plus I love me some Seth. He's just an all around great human being. And he was really instrumental actually in my move to deciding to make the move away from Gartner. Seth was really, really there for me in so many ways. I just love him personally. So I love Purple Cow. I'm looking at my bookshelf right now. I mean, it's a menagerie. I just got Principles, but I haven't gotten through it yet. Yeah. I mean, even if I just look at my book, it's Mapping Innovation. It's The Leadership's Mind. It's What Great Salespeople Do. It's Dealing with Darwin, Zone to Win. I mean,
it's quite
Find
a
Your
few.
Place. I mean, it's all over. I mean,
it's
quite
a few.
Yeah, I mean, I have. It's so funny. People are like, oh, I sent you the book. Did you read it? Like, I'm like, oh my God, I have a stack of like 75 books. And, you know, I want to read them all. I just don't have enough time. But you know, there are ones that I think have. It depends where you are in your career and what you're trying to do. You know, I think early in careers, if you're a woman in tech, a woman in business, there are great books. Brené Brown, or even Sheryl Sandberg's book Lean In, Arianna Huffington's stuff on Thrive. I mean, those are all really great books, and also great for guys too. If it's really business and dealing with it, you know, Inside the Tornado, Innovator's Dilemma, Good to Great, sort of those staple books, In Search of Excellence by Tom Peters. If it's selling books, it just depends. You know, are you a rep and you're an individual contributor and you're trying to be better? There's all kinds of things out of how to be better at social selling or how to be a better storyteller. If you're an executive and you're trying to motivate your company, Nancy Duarte's stuff around better storytelling and Illuminate is really spectacular on creating movements within your own company and how to arrange people in a way that you get them to come along for this ride is spectacular. You know, the stuff on customer experience for Zappos is great. I mean, there's just so many. It just really depends, you know, what you want.
Tiffany, I couldn't ask for a better answer. I really couldn't. And what a great guest. I want to thank you so much for taking the time today and being here with our listeners on Ultimate Guide to Partnering.
Yeah, well, there's no place I would rather be. It's great to get, hopefully, that people listening, you know that I miss you dearly. And I, you know, I see some of you at events and it's not the same as it was, you know, over the last decade, but I'm always out there cheering for you and rooting for you and believe that, you know, that the business is, you know, business is better for the partners that are out there supporting it.
Yep. And for our listeners who want to reach out, I know you're very active on social, your Twitter handle.
Tiffany, TIFFANI _ Bova is my Twitter. And then the What's Next with Tiffany Bova is the new podcast.
Great. And we'll have links to all of this in the show notes. So I want to thank you so much for joining us today. So grateful that you took the time. And I know how compressed your schedule is. So thank you for joining.
Of course.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Ultimate Guide to Partnering with your host, Vince Minzione, online at ultimateguidetopartnering.com and facebook.com/ultimateguidetopartnering. We'll catch you next time on The Ultimate Guide to Partnering.